I very often see things that my students have written.
Mm.
And they'll say, there'll be some whole piece that they've written, and they'll say, Rabbi Joel said the following.
And you don't recognise it.
Not only do I not recognise it, I totally disagree with everything that I've written. And so if I say, such and such a thing, and I learnt that from my rabbi, I'm not saying it because that will establish its truth. I'm establishing my own relationship with the sources of wisdom which have informed me.
Hmm.
When I quote someone, I'm quoting my teacher. And it's a living relationship with an individual. But it's important where that truth came from, because that allows a truth to be honoured, and then that brings that good loops around into the world. Maybe the way we look at people is different when we hear the truths that have been transmitted.
That was my chavruta, my study partner and dear friend, Rabbi Joel Levy. I'm Leon Wiener-Dow, director of the Beit Midrash of Kolot and creator and host of Podrash. Joel and I were discussing a Talmudic text in which Rabbi Elazar says in the name of Rabbi Chanina that whoever properly attributes a quote to its author brings the world closer to redemption. Without quite spelling out what Rabbi Chanina means, we can say this. He thinks that there's something vitally important in the act of attribution, in bringing together the thing said and the person who said it. It's not about plagiarism or proper footnoting. It's about when speaking anonymously allows a woman to come forward and confront her abuser. It's about when nameless trolling unbridles a sense of civility or decency and offers a platform to say vicious things. It's about when namelessly quoting a source allows a journalist or employee to expose an abuse, or a Supreme Court justice to cover her footsteps. We have a lot of Torah to learn. Y'all stay with us. Our text for the day is from Reply All, a podcast that deals with all things internet. It is, or perhaps I should say was, an amazing podcast hosted by PJ Vogt and Alex Goldman. More on the was later. In an episode entitled The Writing on the Wall, which aired in January 2015, Goldman tells the story of the problem of racism at Colgate University as seen through the lens of, and as augmented by, a social media app called Yik Yak. What's special about Yik Yak is that it allows users to make anonymous posts, and it lets you see the posts of users within a 10-mile radius. So in a sense, it allows you to see behind the veil that people present with their smile and small talk. On the flip side, it allows people to share some of their most heartfelt and perhaps ugliest sides without fear of exposure. Melissa Melendez, then a senior at Colgate, who hailed from a poor background in the Bronx, the child of first-generation Puerto Rican parents, led a campus campaign that included a 5-day sit-in, demanding that the university address systematic injustice through policies such as hiring more diverse faculty, conducting diversity training sessions for the financial aid staff, altering the core curriculum, and so forth. But there were parallel universes coexisting uneasily at Colgate.
But meanwhile, on Yik Yak, the sentiment was quite different and pretty disturbing. While Melissa and her friends were occupying the admissions building, there was a parallel protest going on online. Anonymous Yik Yak users protesting the very existence of this sit-in. Here are some yaks that Natasha Torres, one of the founders of the Association for Critical Collegians, screen-capped.
In honor of today, I will only hook up with a minority tonight. I love black people. My maid was always nice to me. Stop being attention-seeking and go home. Let's see. Well, then maybe leave if you don't want to deal with the realities of living in a white world.
So Melissa and her peers, who went by the name the Association of Critical Collegians, ACC, were conducting their campaign publicly. But Yik Yak introduced a thinly veiled underground guerrilla warfare of opinion.
And so Colgate is stuck with something in real life that we all hate on the internet. A trolley anonymous comment section. Here's Charity White, a student at Colgate and a member of the ACC.
It's really really annoying and frustrating to see my peers hiding behind anonymity.
How does it affect your offline life? Does it make you less trusting of people here because you think, oh, maybe this is one of those horrible racist people that I see on Yik Yak?
Yeah. Honestly, sometimes, like I walk around campus sometimes and I think, who posted that terrible thing on Yik Yak? Are they in my classes? Are they my friends? Do I hang out with them at parties? Is that the person who said black girls are hot, just not at Colgate?
The anonymity allowed not merely for a free exchange of ideas, it fostered a language of violence.
I went on Yik Yak and then I saw that they were talking about ACC, but they were also talking about the bitch with the flag, and that would be me.
On Yik Yak, Melissa came to be known as Flag Girl. She was the subject of yaks like, if someone punched Flag Girl in the face, I don't think anyone would mind. Or,
bash that bitch's head in. So I try to brush everything off, which is a problem sometimes. But at the moment, at the time, I couldn't brush it off. Like, I was really upset. I was, like, crying, and I was like, you see, look at the world. To see, like, 70 or 80 people like something that says I deserve to die, I think that it was disheartening.
The university thought that perhaps the solution would be to remove the veil of anonymity.
Colgate contacted both the local and state police and asked the Madison County District Attorney's Office to determine whether a grand jury subpoena could be used to compel Yik Yak to disclose information about some of its worst yaks. Independent of the police investigation, the school and its lawyers sent separate requests for identifying information to Yik Yak. But both the requests to the district attorney and to Yik Yak were denied.
Amidst this vitriol, a few professors tried a counterattack, informed by a diametrically opposed strategy. Instead of anonymity, they posted with their names. In the place of meanness, they shared words of encouragement.
As a way to counteract racism, this seems totally ridiculous. The faculty were violating one of the cardinal rules of the internet. Kindness never works. But to see these older professors making cheesy dad jokes and offering good-natured and unironic congratulations to people and getting way more upvotes than the racist stuff, it had a surprisingly strong effect on the students.
I love it. I love it. I thought it was so cute. 'Cause I knew why they were doing it. Like they were making a statement. And I liked how a lot of them signed their names. I thought that was powerful. They were like, you know, screw being anonymous. Like, this was Professor Thompson.
All the students I spoke to echoed this sentiment. Professor Eddie Watkins noticed the effect as well.
At some point during the day, around lunch, I went up to the COOP, the union, student union, for lunch. And I ran into a young woman who had been a very important member of the ACC movement. And she really struggled this semester. And, you know, she, I saw her and she burst into tears. And she said, you have no idea what this means to us. We felt so alone. And so that, you know, I think, you know, it seemed like a silly thing we were doing, but it really impacted some of these people. I mean, she was greatly moved by that. And it just, you know, it was a great way that, I mean, we're so helpless in some ways against this.
It had an effect, but it didn't tip the balance, which would seem to affirm what we probably already think. Anonymity is inimical because it allows people to hide behind their true opinions. But actually, Melissa had something else to say.
Before Yik Yak showed up, Colgate was a place where Melissa saw people express racist ideas all the time, but no one admitted they were racist or that their friends were.
I think that before, people just felt crazy. Like, and by people, I mean like people like me. Like, I was like, I feel this way, I feel uncomfortable. People say these things, but I don't have any proof that this exists. And so like, it seems like people can just brush it off. Well, that's not a big deal. Someone put their fingers in your hair, that's not a big deal. But like with Yik Yak, because the Yik Yak posts were so explicitly racist and violent, it forced a conversation on this campus that a lot of people were trying to avoid having.
I want to welcome to Podrash a longtime friend and peer, Rabbi J. Henry Moses. Jay is vice president of the Wexner Foundation, having served many, many years as the director of the Wexner Heritage Program, which is, as probably many of our listeners know, North America's premier Jewish leadership education program. Rabbi Moses pursued rabbinical studies at Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion, and was awarded a Wexner Graduate Fellowship. He was ordained in 1997 and served 5 years as associate rabbi at Temple Shalom in Chicago. He's published essays in 4 books in the series on iHoliday prayers, published by Jewish Lights Publication, and he's contributed insights on the role of religion in the process of healing from tragedy for Sheryl Sandberg's book, Option B. He also serves as the editor-at-large of Shabbat, A Day of Rest, a special section of Arianna Huffington's Thrive Global media channel. That is J. Henry Moses' sparkling biography. And more than that, he is a great person and a dear friend. Jay, it is a pleasure to have you on Podrash. Thank you for being here.
It is an absolute honor to join you, my dear friend and colleague, Leon.
Let's start by giving a little bit of background, which I promised in the introduction that we'd say something more about Reply All having been an amazing podcast. Maybe by the time our episode drops, it'll be clear where Reply All is going, but we're recording after Reply All issued 2 parts of a series, which then kind of got complicated for them because they were reporting on a workplace that had a rather formidable and unpleasant environment for its employees of diverse backgrounds. And then it turns out that there was something very similar going on at Reply All, specifically with co-host PJ Vogt and Sruthi Pinnamaneni, the reporter who did that. And I think that it's kind of, number one, important to acknowledge. And number two, I think that it might actually help us focus on what we want to talk about today. So I want to start by just asking what initial reactions you had to the podcast, to the episode Writing on the Wall. And along the way, or at the beginning of your words, you're welcome to relate to Reply All's status.
We are living in a moment which is precarious when it comes to the realm of ideas and free speech and people feeling safe in workplaces and on campuses. And it is sad to see a really quality show like Reply All get caught up in that kind of situation. But unfortunately, it seems to be more and more common. I can tell you that, you know, when you shared with me that that was going to be the episode we were going to talk about in this conversation, I said, well, if it tells you anything, I remember that listening to that episode from 5 years ago. And if you remember a podcast 5 years later, that's really saying something. On one level, I was horrified by the fact that there's that level of racism that exists on college campuses these days. Maybe I'm a bit of an idealist, thinking that, you know, well-educated college students are a little bit more open and tolerant, generally speaking. But I was really, really troubled by the idea that social media is going in a direction allowing the id, the sort of uncontrolled id of people's worst sides to emerge. And it seems like one of the most unhealthy dimensions of today's media landscape and sort of today's marketplace of ideas as well. And I think it's one part of what has to be a much larger reckoning that our society has to take seriously about where the lines are between free speech and accountability, and how we create environments and systems in workplaces and on campuses that allow people to feel safe, first and foremost, and also allow people to encounter ideas that make them uncomfortable, encounter genuine differences and disagreements, and emerge from them having learned and grown rather than having destroyed one another's feelings and reputations. It can be an incredibly, you know, words are powerful and they can be an incredibly destructive force. And the tools that we have, including social media, can either advance conversation and civilization, or they can be a force for destructiveness. And this was a case where it seemed pretty clear that Yik Yak was a destructive force.
So Jay, I want to focus on one of the things that you raised. There's the issue of safety and the kind of vitriol that a lot of people use in the way that they express themselves on social media, or at all, obviously. But I want to focus in and hone in specifically on what I think is obviously very central to Yik Yak and to this episode, which is the extent to which anonymity, not just social media, but anonymity in this particular form allows me to say things that otherwise I wouldn't say. Obviously, these are things that are going through my head or my heart, but when I have to attach my name to them, then I'm not willing to say them.
Yeah. Well, anonymity is one of those forces that can cut both ways, right? On the one hand, anonymity is something that can offer a voice to the powerless. There are people who might not be able to put their name behind their words in some instances because the consequences they would face would be intolerable, where their voice would be ignored or dismissed, or they would be punished in some way. So there are times when giving anonymous cover allows somebody to express really important truths, to work for justice. And I want to just acknowledge that that's one side of the coin, and it's a side of the coin that we shouldn't lose sight of. The flip side of that coin, of course, is that anonymity gives people cover for everything from routine hurts toward other people to committing actual crimes. And I think it's a force that we have to be very, very careful with, because it can provide cover for forces that we would, you know, much rather keep out of the public square. And I think more often than not, people should be held accountable for their words.
We're going to come back to that. We'll swing back to that, and I'll probably push you a little bit on it. Before we go too far down this road, I want to start by asking you, after you listen to the podcast or re-listen to it in preparation for our conversation and started to try to think about it and the questions that it raises for us by framing it Jewishly, share with me the text that came to mind for you.
The first thing that jumped to my mind is this notion that we have in our tradition of B'Shem Omro, saying something in the name of the person who originally said it. In other words, attribution or crediting someone with their original words or thoughts, which is valorized in our tradition and the Talmud. Rabbi Elazar said that Rabbi Hanina said that a person who quotes his original sources, right, who attributes something B'Shem Omro, mevi ge'ula l'olam, brings redemption to the world. And this notion that being public with credit for where an idea comes from is something to be aspired to, essentially. And that the implication there is that if you appropriate someone else's words without credit, you're committing a pretty grave sin, right? Plagiarism is kind of the modern version of that. So that was the first notion that jumped to mind.
First of all, thank you for adding, there's that core statement that anyone who brings a teaching with or in the name of someone else brings redemption to the world. But as you pointed out, it's purposeful that it's brought in the name of someone, and it's not in the name of someone, it's in the name of two people, meaning Rabbi Elazar quotes Rabbi Hanina, who says this following things. And I'll add on the flip, on the other side, kind of bookending it, is the Babylonian Talmud, the Tractate of Megillah. And the end of it says, brings a proof text to support this idea. And the proof text that's brought to support this idea is from the book of Esther, which we read on Purim. And it says, and Esther said to the king, in the name of Mordechai, right? So it's playing off of this idea, which is I think very, very purposeful, that there is something very, very important in the book of Esther about the incredible confluence of chance that happens there, that there is thing after thing after thing happens, and we don't know exactly what it happens. And really what happened is that Mordechai overheard people who were whispering and plotting to kill the king, and he reports it to Esther, and Esther reports that it came from Mordechai, and she kind of keeps the attribution. And because of that, eventually the king is thankful to Mordechai. So there's, I think, kind of something very, very interesting going on about the importance of attribution and about not stealing, but also about the fact that ideas have origins, and it is really impossible to separate the origin from the person who brought that idea forth and who was the vehicle for that idea. And so somehow we do something destructive when we separate that and we do something constructive, or even in the language of that of Rabbi Hanina, we do something redemptive when we preserve that connection between the person and what they said.
Yeah, and not only that, it takes courage, right? This is the first step that Esther takes toward outing herself as a Jew, right? In a certain way, and her family connections. And
beautiful, yeah.
And she, you know, there's no guarantee that the end of this is going to result in her safety, but she is already trusting in the process that by being transparent, even if it potentially puts her, her cousin, her people in some danger, she's relying ultimately on the power of the truth. And that's something that is rewarded, but it is precarious.
It's very precarious. It's quite possible to imagine that when King Ahasuerus was choosing who's going to be the next queen, if he had known from the get-go that Esther was Jewish, she might not have been selected. It's actually kind of a double-edged sword. I would, you know, kind of challenge from the different direction and say, okay, well, that's true. It's good thing that she owned it and she stated and she didn't hide behind her being Jewish at this point in the story. On the other hand, it might not have gotten to this point in the story had she revealed her identity from the get-go. So this kind of, I think, in a certain sense, gets back to that first thing you were saying about the time, about the fact that there are times when anonymity is critical.
Right.
When I won't be able to say what I believe if someone knows that it's coming from me, whether it's in a workplace, saying something about my employer, which kind of gets back to this whole reply all issue, or whether it's on a, you know, a political poll, if someone wants to know what I think or who I'm going to vote for. There's a place in which anonymity allows us to do things which themselves might be redemptive.
Yeah, that story shows the whole spectrum from anonymity as a protective force to public attribution as a redemptive force. It's interesting as well, if you look at the context in which that statement comes in the Talmud, right? It's one in a long series of statements that are attributed to that chain of those two rabbis. Mm. And they aren't all connected to Esther and the Megillah. They're not all connected to each other as well. It seems like they're lumped together only because they carry that same line of attribution. And to me, that says that in our tradition, in the Talmudic tradition, the rabbis are teaching us that in a certain way, you are the sum total of your teachings, right? Your words create the world that you inhabit and they create your legacy. And that is to be valued above almost all else.
Let's explore. Let's go into those spaces where to refrain from saying something that I really believe, convention or power dynamics.
Temporary social forces, right?
Yeah, right. Where instead of being truthful, what they cause me to do is in the name of civility or in the name of conflict avoidance, I actually hide behind what I really think. And I'm not talking about this kind of situations, of extreme situations that this episode of Reply All raises. Maybe also that, right? Melissa at the end of the podcast says, well, she's glad to know, because for a while she was walking around the campus of Colgate thinking things were better than they are. So maybe there's something quote unquote redemptive and good about the possibility of anonymity insofar as it allows me to say what I really honestly believe. And boy, the world is a better place if you know that these are the things that are going through my head and my heart.
Well, there are some thoughts and ideas that may go through our heads from time to time, and they're better left there, right? and I think that's one of the ways in which anonymity can be a destructive force. Not every thought or impulse should actually be expressed or acted upon. And when I think of anonymity as an unleashing force, right, there are some, our yetzer hara, our worst inclinations should be kept leashed within us. That's the spiritual discipline that Judaism asks of us. And so the difference between expressing a truth that needs to be expressed because it's going to serve some larger important purpose, right? And if you need a cloak of anonymity to do that, great, go ahead. But that every thought you have, including your most vicious or immature or angry thoughts, that they should all be able to be freely expressed is a recipe for kind of the end of civilization in a certain way.
I want to actually bring up here the fact that Maimonides, right, in his introduction to the Guide to the Perplexed, gives a long list of reasons why sometimes authors have contradictions in their work. And one of the final things that he mentions is, and I'm quoting here, he says, in speaking about very obscure matters, it's necessary to conceal some parts and to disclose others, right? So the Rambam, Maimonides is saying that there are sometimes, and here I'll just mention in passing, right, that there's a work by the philosopher Leo Strauss called Persecution and the Art of Writing, where he talks about the way that sometimes philosophers, when they're saying something very dangerous, they have to either hide through the mechanism of anonymity, a pen name, or hide by hiding what they really think, and only very devout and esoteric readers will be able to understand exactly what they're saying. So there might be instances in which truth demands, and the world is made better by hiding behind that cloak of anonymity that you referred to.
Absolutely. And my sense is, without being a specialist in the medieval period, that it was a time where the intellectual currents and the political currents were especially forceful and forced some people underground in that way. Not long after Maimonides, along comes the Zohar, the great work and compendium of Jewish mystical teaching, believed to be penned largely by Moshe de Leon, who did not attach his name to the teaching at all, but instead sort of allowed it to be by implication that it was a book that had been written by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai 1,000 years earlier and only suddenly discovered and revealed, you know, presumably because that ancient lineage would give it more clout, right? And allow it to be more accepted as authoritative and have an air of mystery around it, but also possibly because the ideas in it were considered to be dangerous.
Actually, I think your example of the Zohar is a great example, because for Moshe de Leon, it wasn't enough to be anonymous. He actually does a false attribution, right? I mean, there are times, as I mentioned earlier, where I need the safety of anonymity, or as you said, the cloak of anonymity, in order to voice some critique or to voice something that otherwise I won't have the courage to do. And there are other times, right, where if people say it's coming from me, they're going to judge it in a certain way. But oh, if it's Jay Moses who said that, wow, you know, Jay is a smart guy, and it must be a good idea, right? It's what Kahneman called the halo effect, right? Where, like, sometimes because someone who we already hold in high esteem said something, then we'll give it a benefit of the doubt or relate to it positively in a way that we won't if it's Moshe de Leon who brought these same ideas.
For sure. On a really important level, this is a conversation about power, right? And who has the power to have to be able to express unpopular ideas and survive it? Who has the power to be listened to? And who, you know, uses anonymity as a force for creating a power dynamic over others? You know, in Reply All, the incident that you mentioned at the beginning that's throwing Reply All's future into question right now was about staff members, newer and less powerful staff members, especially people of color, feeling like they didn't have a voice at their company, and that the more established powerful players like Sruthi Panamanini, who is herself a person of color, didn't want to join in their effort and wanted to suppress their effort because it was a threat to her and her power from within. So it's a very subtle, complicated.
Yeah, so actually, this is a very interesting reframing that you're offering. Maybe the way of framing it is the one that you just suggested, which is we need to think about it as a function of power dynamic. And if what we think is that anonymity is going to allow me to create a level playing field, right? It's going to allow me to somehow correct the imbalance in power, then it would be legitimate and maybe even important to be able to express myself anonymously. Whereas if what it is going to be a force of oppression or a way to exacerbate an already problematic power dynamic, then the anonymity is a force of destruction, which I need to cast aside.
I think that's exactly right. Standing behind your own ideas and putting your name and your voice behind them, as well as crediting others for their own ideas, is the default, is the norm, is the ideal that we should aspire to, right? We should be able to be in a society where everybody can express their ideas, have their ideas heard, have their ideas challenged, and learn and grow together, and do that all above board and in the sunlight. That's the ideal. when trying to reach that aspiration is impossible because your voice won't be heard, or because the power dynamic is such that you would take on great risk by doing that, or not feel safe doing that, mm-hmm. then employ anonymity as a last resort if you have to, in order to, as you said, level the power dynamics and get an important piece of truth out into the world that would not be able to be effectively communicated otherwise.
Beautiful. So your addition and maybe correction to what I said is that there's a kind of overarching aspiration to wed together the person and what that person is saying. And that's the idea of that Rabbi Hanina brings, La vie de Val B'Shem Omro, right? To connect what the person said and who said it. And that's what we should be aspiring to. But we have to accept the fact that the world is imperfect. And so sometimes, because the world is imperfect and there are obstacles to our living that way, and one of the obstacles, maybe the one of the primary obstacles, is an inimical power dynamic, there will be situations where anonymity, the veil of anonymity, will allow us to kind of do a corrective, to separate, you know, kind of a temporary severance of the person from what they said, in order to correct the imbalance, the power imbalance.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you. Rabbi J. Henry Moses, it was a pleasure to have you. Thank you very, very much for being here on Padrash.
It was a delight to be with you, Leon. You're doing great work.
Padrash is a project of Kolot, a fantastic organization in Israel, where I'm privileged to direct the Beit Midrash. Before we continue on to our hypertext segment, we'll break briefly in order to meet Ruby Gat, an independent filmmaker and a Kolot alumnus. I thought that meeting him could give an opportunity to meet one of the very special people who learns with us and to hear how learning at Kolot impacted him.
My name is Ruby Gat. I was born in Jerusalem to a traditional family. That means Kiddush on Shabbat, synagogues on the high holidays, but not much more than that. I now live with my partner and our three children in the village of Abu Ghosh, near the city. I'm a filmmaker and I'm a member of a Reform congregation in Mevaseret Zion.
Can you tell us a little bit about your work as a filmmaker?
I'm a documentary director. I did two documentaries. One is a Holocaust related, and one is about my eldest son, which sits in a wheelchair. So basically, it's about disability rights. I followed his struggle to get enlisted to the IDF against all odds, and in the end, they managed to do it as a success story.
It was a success story, and I will add a beautiful, beautiful film.
Thank you.
And we'll have a link to your profile, and people can read about the film. Ruby, can you share a moment during your time learning at Kolot that stayed with you or that impacted you and maybe even influenced how you do or what you do?
I'll start by saying that most of my adult life, I used to learn Jewish studies in various groups and institutions, looking for voice I could relate to. And I'm speaking about women equality, for example, or acceptance and welcoming the LGBT community, which I'm part of. So when I arrived to Kolot, I was expecting to hear voices that are closer to mine, a narrative that, as I said, I could connect with. And nevertheless, I was surprised to find out that in these ancient Jewish scripts, you can find the voices that are even more progressive than the way I see myself. I remember the lesson we learned Bab Metzia, and we're speaking about shaming other people, Albanat Panim, and I think it was Rav Nachman that says over there that shaming other people is equal to blood spilling. I never in my life thought shaming other people is nice or acceptable, but it was there that I realized how important it is to frame it and call it by its name. It's not that it's not nice or not acceptable. It's dangerous. Keep away from me. Of course, I took it to my daily life, and I always, when arguing with other people or having conflicts with other people, I always keep it in mind. And actually, I found out that it changes the atmosphere. Once you don't go to the extreme, it's much easier to find the common ground with other people that are different than you.
Ruby Gad, thank you for being with us and for sharing.
My pleasure, Laura. Thank you very much.
Like every episode of Padrash, Learning at Kolot pulses between the text as discussed in the Beit Midrash and the broken reality that surrounds us, beckoning us to hear voices of wisdom that can point the way to a better world. To learn more about Kolot, visit www.kolot.net. And now, back to our episode. In the Hypertext segment, we turn to a practitioner of some discipline, a journalist, a therapist, an educator, a consultant, to allow us to examine the episode's issue from an unexpected perspective, thus ensuring that the Torah of the Beit Midrash and the Torah of life mix fully. Today I invited Dahlia Lithwick, a seasoned journalist, to help us think through the tension between truth and anonymity, since journalists struggle so frequently with this quandary. Dahlia is a senior editor at Slate, and she writes frequently about the Supreme Court, as well as hosting Amicus, Slate's award-winning bi-weekly podcast about the law and the Supreme Court. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Harper's, The New Yorker, The Washington Post, The New Republic, and Commentary, among other places. Originally from Ottawa, Lithwick earned her BA in English from Yale University and her JD from Stanford. She's currently working on a new book, Lady Justice, for Penguin Press. Most importantly, she's the only guest of Padrash who's also been on The Daily Show. Dahlia, it is a pleasure to have you on Padrash. Thank you for joining us.
It's a joy to be here. Thank you for having me.
We're trying to explore the question of anonymity from every possible side, with a special attention to the question of when does anonymity provide a safe haven for someone who is in need of it? In order to voice, issue forth their voice or find a space to say what they need to say? And when alternatively, does anonymity offer a kind of inimical way for someone to hide behind what they believe in and maybe use what they believe in as a source of hurt for someone else? I'm hoping that maybe you as a journalist will help shed some light on that. When as a journalist, do you look for anonymity? And when do you shy away from it?
The simple answer is we always prefer to have people on the record. It's always a better story. It's more credible. My editor would tell you, push, push, push to get someone on the record. Mm-hmm. Across the industry, there is a strong preference that people come on the record for obvious reasons of accountability, which I know is what we're talking about today. But frequently we have sources who are vulnerable for all sorts of reasons. And if they were to come forward either as a whistleblower or as, you know, somebody embedded in government or somebody who would be in peril of losing their job or in peril of, you know, mortal danger, then we are prepared to provide anonymity to them. And I think the rule of thumb is, first of all, it's got to be factual. We don't give an anonymity to people to voice their opinions. Mm-hmm. But if there is a part of a story that they can tell that we can't get elsewhere, and also we try very hard at that point to find more than one person so that, you know, you've got four or five corroborating voices, but essentially that we will give it. And by the way, it's not for me to give as a journalist, I have to go up the chain and get permission. Mm-hmm. But I think that the idea is if there is a story that must be told, and usually it's a story about power and abuse, whether it's in government or some other entity, then we are prepared to provide anonymity and with the caveat that we then fact check the heck out of it.
So let me push you a little bit on that if I could. You said that you'll give anonymity for the sake of fact, but not opinion. And I'm thinking about a piece that you share with me that you wrote about Jed Rubenfeld and two Yale Law School students who came forth anonymously, each of them, independent of the other. And I'm thinking, okay, well, in that piece, as is often the case, the lines are sometimes not quite so clear between fact and opinion. So help me there. When would you say, okay, well, that we've now crossed the threshold and now I'm going to have to rescind, you know, that benefit of anonymity that I was willing to give to you?
You're exactly right. And for that story particularly, which was a big sweeping look at a Title IX investigation of a Yale professor who was alleged to have acted inappropriately in several over many years with several students, in addition to having quotes from former students and students about things that he had said and done, which were very factual, I think we did, you're quite right, leech sometimes into how it made them feel, only because we were trying to get a sense of these are students who felt that it had kind of crossed over from a professor who was being provocative to a professor who was behaving in a predatory or harassing fashion. But you're quite right. Some of that is impressionistic and it is opinion. Here we had, I don't know how many sources, unbelievable number of sources from that story. And from the lowliest people who were still law students to people who were 10 years out of law school, not willing to go on the record.
Right.
And not willing to go on the record, even when pushed, because they felt as though this world we were trying to penetrate of rarefied law school, rarefied clerkships, getting opportunities to work with judges and years out of their clerkships didn't want to bring shame on their judges. And it's an amazing paradox, right? That even people who are now in a position of power were afraid to come forward with their names. And that it both illuminates, I think, the problem you're trying to illustrate and the solution.
When I talked about the blurring or the bleeding, I did not at all mean it as a critique. I was actually thinking of it almost from the opposite standpoint, which is to say, if someone experiences, right, if you and I are in a room and I experience your behavior towards me is kind of creepy, right? So it's going to be very hard for me to articulate that. And I can say she was close to me, or she made a comment about my hair or whatever, which felt like it crossed a line. And I'm actually thinking of it from the opposite place, which is that this is someone who's disempowered. And the fact that they're disempowered kind of makes them less willing to stand behind the legitimacy of that feeling that they have. If I can't produce a fact that somehow makes it clear cut, then I'm not only called into question by others, but I myself have kind of internalized those callings into question so much so that I might even now start to doubt myself.
I love that. That's such a good insight, Leon. It's been such a pervasive theme in all of our Me Too reporting, just around these questions of powerful figures who are never held to account and these quote unquote open secrets, right? These are always kind of Harvey Weinstein, where everybody knows, but nobody talks about it.
Right.
And such a consistent through line in the reporting. And you really see this, by the way, in Jody Cantor and Megan Tuohy's book about Harvey Weinstein, is the gaslighting, the feeling that the victims have of maybe it was just me, maybe I was making it up, just the persistent feeling of, yeah, this happened. Yeah, it happened 30 times, but I either figured I was imagining it, or I thought I did something to invite it. And so in a strange way, conferring anonymity on people and then letting them just, again, these stories, that Yale story took weeks and weeks and weeks of reporting, because you have to let people talk. And as they talk, you get this sense that they're like, oh, actually, that wasn't okay. I just didn't. Or frequently, again, in that story, we would have bystanders in the classroom. And this is a whole other Me Too rabbit hole, but bystanders who witness things and would say things like, oh, yeah, no, I saw that. That was really hinky. It made me feel very strange, but I didn't do anything or say anything. I felt like it wasn't my place. And only when you have four bystanders corroborating, oh yeah, no, we saw that happened in small section. I didn't come forward. I'm not going to put my name on the record, but she's absolutely right when she says that made the whole class shudder. A lot of that is done anonymously.
Let me kind of try to attack from a different angle and ask the question from the establishment's perspective. When you're covering a law case, a judge wants to go off the record or even issue an opinion, what you refer to as the docket decisions, right? Where the Supreme Court is issuing opinions anonymously. How does the anonymity play itself out in that regard?
So this is a huge other, I'm trying to decide if I want to say kettle of fish or can of worms. And I'm going to say it's a kettle of worms. And it is something we're really noticing now at the U.S. Supreme Court level, which is, as you say, the advent of this thing called the shadow docket. Professor Will Bode wrote about it when it was almost a theoretical problem a few years ago, where the court was deciding, this is the Supreme Court, deciding cases that are unbriefed. They're often on an emergency basis. Sometimes they would just decide a case with a paragraph. It became known as the shadow docket because it was in direct tension with how at least the U.S. Supreme Court is supposed to decide cases, which is it gets entirely played out at the lower courts. Then it goes to the appeals courts. It is briefed. It is argued. We have oral arguments. We have amicus briefs from interested parties. It is as much information as the court can have, at which point they write a reasoned order, right? With named majority opinion and named dissenters. And what's really happened, and we've seen a massive increase in this, is the court deciding things on an emergency basis in orders that are not even signed. So we will have, and we've really seen it come up with these COVID cases in the States. There's been an immense amount of litigation around synagogues and churches who want to push back on state and local COVID orders. And these cases kind of rabbit up to the Supreme Court. The court decides them on an emergency basis, and we don't have an order. So in other words, the court is doing the opposite of what the court is meant to do, which is show your work, act as to afford guidance to lower courts reviewing these cases. And also in the most recent COVID cases, and also we've seen this in the death penalty docket too, you'll get a funny, it's hard to imagine something less legal. You'll get a funny order that says the court has said X, there's no reasoning, that hasn't been briefed, it hasn't been argued. And in one of the most extraordinary cases in the last couple of weeks, we actually didn't know who the fifth vote was. So one of the justices in the five, in the majority, we don't know which of the justices it is. And so I think this is a long way of saying that if you want accountability upward now, then you need to know which justice is which and who has voted how, and actually what the holding of the case is, what the rule is the case of the case is going forward. And the reason I think this is, it bookends this conversation about powerless people who are trying to hold the powerful to account, is now we have powerful people who are hiding quite literally behind one sentence orders that simply say the lower court is overturned. Good luck. Best of luck.
Can you imagine a situation in which you would say it would be okay for a judge to issue, or for a court to issue, an opinion anonymously for some reasons?
I can't think of it as I'm thinking of it right now. I will say the Supreme Court is such a funny phenomenon. For much of its history, the Supreme Court wanted to be in the posture of, we're actually not nine separate justices or six or seven or whatever the number was. We're just brains in vats. And so, for instance, when I first started covering the court, which is 20 years ago, it was a very new phenomenon when you would get a transcript of an oral argument, right? So after the case was argued at the court, you wouldn't know if it was Justice Kennedy or Justice Souter asking the question. The transcript literally read the court. And if you were trying to figure out, yeah, why? Because it doesn't matter, they would say. We're just nine oracles, just chilling with the framers, you know, trying to figure out.
I'm thinking how different it is from Jewish law. And that's actually the piece that Jay Moses brought in our previous segment, that the idea is, that somehow you have to attach the teaching or the position to someone's name. So it's kind of inconceivable, right? That was, of course, what Maimonides tried to do in the Mishnah Torah, and it didn't work, right? Somehow detach, you know, who said something from the position. So it's just kind of amazing. My jaw is on the floor hearing that.
My jaw was on the floor. Here's the flip, because I think it's important, and it does push back a little bit on your point about how we think about the rabbis. When Brown versus Board comes down, right? So that's the landmark.
Even I remember that.
Right. So this is the landmark school desegregation case. Justice Warren was at pains to make sure that was unanimous. It was incredibly important that the court speak in one voice. And there is a longstanding, again, it kind of is counter to how we think about how the rabbis teach, but there was a longstanding fight, particularly in the early days of the U.S. Supreme Court, where they didn't want dissenters. They didn't want published dissents, because a published dissent, now we're off the question of anonymity, but a published dissent suggests that the institution is in tension about this internally. I think that idea that the institution operates as an institution that transcends its members' personal opinions. As much as you and I are slagging it right now, there are moments at which it's extremely important to say, the court has spoken, all of us. And so it's just a counterpoint to the shadow docket unpublished opinions. I don't know if that helps.
That's
helps
fantastic.
You at all.
That's, yeah, it okay. Absolutely does. So now I'm going to ask you the hardest question of all, which is, you know, how you, Dalia, when you struggle with this issue, not as a reporter, but just in your life, right? When there are times when you want to say something with your name, and there are times when you want something said, and you may be even are willing to be or want to be the person saying it, but you feel that circumstance requires you to distance your name from what it is that you're saying. Are there guidelines that you take from your professional life on the kind of things that we've been talking about, and kind of import them and help you work through the process?
The immediate example I think about is very early in my career, when I had been covering the Supreme Court and was really like scrabbling in a press corps that is very distinguished, full of, you know, prize winners and very gravitas and sober. And I was this kind of baby reporter. I didn't come up through journalism. I came through law school. I didn't know things. And I was young, and I was a woman, and I was funny and irreverent. I was in an online magazine, which at the time was like basically, you know, like being a stripper. Like, it was not seen as serious journalism. And not long into my tenure there, when I was finally starting to feel like I was being taken seriously, I actually had a series of miscarriages and made the decision to write about that in my name as me. And one of my mentors at the time said, you know what, don't, like, this is going to dilute the brand. It's going to confuse people. It's going to make you like a personal essayist. And this was at a moment, you may recall, where like the personal essay was really just being born as a form. And I really sat with it. And then I thought, maybe it's going to be good for people who are younger than me, who come after me, to know not just that, you know, one in four women loses a pregnancy, but that like the person who's sitting like in the third row at the Supreme Court that you see on CNN also had one. And so like, for right or for wrong, I made the decision to do it in my name. And I'm actually have never been prouder of doing it in my name, because I wanted to model that we are complicated, real human beings. And it felt important. So that's my sort of reflexive answer. Here, I guess, is the only other thing I would say. And I've been sitting with the podcast you played, and I've been thinking about this double-edged sword of anonymity, right? It both affords the powerless opportunities to come forward. It also affords, you know, the bullies and the thugs opportunities to terrorize. And I keep thinking, this is my favorite quote. I know it is not in any way from the Talmud, but I'm going to offer it anyway, because it's like the sage wisdom I have. It comes from Homer Simpson.
One of our great Jewish teachers.
Exactly. Buckle in, it gets worse. He says, believe it or not, of beer. Beer. It is the cause of and solution to all of our problems. And lest you think I'm dropping this on you in a spirit of silliness, I actually like said this to Justice Kennedy once, Anthony Kennedy of the US Supreme Court, because I think actually the same is true of anonymous speech. And I think that one of the things you're struggling with, not that I can in any way be sanguine about it, is that the Federalist Papers were anonymous, right? Like, I think there were broadsheets that were at the founding that were anonymous. And there are good reasons for that. It can be the single most democracy-affording thing to have anonymous technology.
Right.
At the same time, it is absolutely true that, particularly in a moment that we are in right now, anonymous trolling can threaten the lives of people in power, journalists, whatever.
First of all, I want to thank you very, very much for sharing. I didn't know about that piece that you had written early on about your miscarriage. And actually, our first pregnancy, my wife's first pregnancy, ended in a miscarriage, and we had others along the way. And what we found most disturbing was really it's just something that's not talked about, right? That where people are anonymous about it. And so there's something very powerful about your willingness, you know, not just to share it, but to share it publicly with your name. But I do want to ask, even with that sense of pride, which I think is just extremely justified that you have in the fact that you did that, do you feel like you paid a price? Was it all good? Or was there something that you said, okay, well, I had to pay that price, but on balance, I'm still glad I did it?
I don't think I paid any concrete price. I think that the world had already begun to and has continued to shift away from the notion that even serious journalists have to be robotic and dissociated from their lives and their feelings. And the conflation of opinion and reporting had already begun. But I also think journalism qua journalism has paid for the collapse of opinion into straight reporting. It has paid for the celebritification of journalists, the idea that your quote unquote brand is important. All of that, I think, is fundamentally not good for journalism. The ways in which we have become the story, I think, is deeply, deeply problematical for the pursuit of truth that we're supposed to be doing. So I don't have a great wisdom for it other than to say, as with most vices, it's like justifiable when we do it. It's not when someone else does it. And so I just worry very, very much that the advent of the celebrity journalist is part of what is contributing to a lack of trust in the media generally, and just not necessarily fantastic choices about how we practice this craft.
Well, I would disagree with you when you say that that's not a great piece of wisdom. The great piece of wisdom I think that you're holding is it can be both. It is both. And so that means that we have to be attentive to when not summarily dismiss it and not summarily invoke it, but to be thoughtful and to see when it's working in which direction. And to make a value choice about when to use it based on that thought. So, Dahlia Lithwick, thank you very, very much for being with us on Padrash. It's a really pleasure.
Oh, it's a joy. It's a joy. Thank you.
The naked truth. It's quite a turn of phrase, a crazy concept, really. Like it's just out there, detached, floating weightlessly in the ether. Kind of like a brain in a vat, as Dahlia Lithwick said the Supreme Court judges aspired to be. Disconnected from the person uttering it. I'm imagining a world, an alternative universe, not this world, not this lying world, in which there are no discrepancies in power, in which you and I, whoever that may be, are always on equal footing. We face each other eye to eye, and we can say to one another whatever we need to, with no threats ensuing, no fears of repercussions. That's where naked truth could reside, in that world where we didn't have to hide behind what we're saying. But in our world, in the Alma de Shikra, this lying world, power dynamics almost always determine the course of our conversations, which is why we can even fathom as an aspiration speaking truth to power. As Rabbi J. Moses pointed out, the cloak of anonymity is a necessary tool when we can't live out the ideal of someone owning what they're saying. By implication, Rabbi Elazar says in the name of Rabbi Hanina that in a redeemed world, names and statements would always be linked. Why is that? I think that my chavruta, Rabbi Joel Levy, was onto something when he suggested that truth is relational. The truth becomes the truth as I understand it. The truth as so-and-so taught me. That doesn't relativize truth. It situates it. It contextualizes it. It roots it. Just think for a moment about the students who had been harassed by their professor, but who didn't come forward until Dahlia Lithwick offered the veil of anonymity. It was through extended and expansive conversations, she said, that the gaslighting was extinguished, that women could believe their own experiences, that opinion could morph into fact. Each person speaking her truth. It's not just corroboration, it's verification in its literal sense, the establishing of truth. Truth isn't naked, it's a collective endeavor. According to Rabbi Elazar in the name of Rabbi Hanina, when Esther said to Ahasuerus in the name of Mordechai, that was an act of truth through and through. Mordechai had overheard something, and he reported it to Esther, who in turn reported it to Ahasuerus with proper attribution. Esther was a reporter of sorts, kind of like P.J. Vogt and Sruthi Pinnamaneni of Reply All, only they used their reporting as a kind of smokescreen for anonymity, pointing at the toxic workplace somewhere else rather than acknowledging their own situation, whereas Esther bravely risked the complicated truth of her situation, inconvenient as it was. What's at stake, as I said at the beginning of the episode, is not proper footnoting. It's about living in a world in which truth need not speak to power because it is power. Truth need not hide its situational nature, its local color, out of fear that acknowledging it will weaken its hand. This kind of truth, relational truth, is redemptive, for it allows the world to realize its fullest potential. Padrash is a project of Kolot. I'm Leon Wiener-Dow, creator and host. My sincere thanks go to this episode's guests, Rabbi J. Henry Moses and Dahlia Lithwick, to our producer, Noam Zuckerman, to David Goodman and Aaron Harris for their masterful sound editing, to my chavruta, Rabbi Joel Levy, for the learning, the wisdom, and the lesson about letting go of our words once we've brought them into the world, and to Michael Goel Samir for the original music. Please visit our website at www.podrash.org, where you'll find links to the original episode of Reply All and to Joel's and my extended chavruta, along with the texts that we reference. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your friends, tweet, like our page on Facebook, and please give us a 5-star rating and write a review. It has to help. Or why else would I keep repeating this? We'll be back next week with Episode 7, News, Narratives, and Truths. Thanks for joining us.
To alcohol, the cause of and solution to all of life's problems.